agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at North Kentucky University. I'm joined today by Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson. Hey, Jay.
Good morning, Mike.
How are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'll tell you, I am more frazzled than a Confederate statue on campus.
Oh, very good. You had that one ready, locked and loaded. I love it. Excellent. All right. Hey, I'm doing okay myself. I don't have anything particularly witty. Let's hope that improves over time. But before we do get started, I just want to thank our newest monthly sustaining supporters on Patreon. We have a bunch of them because I've been off for a couple of weeks. Kirk, Sharmix, Suzanne, Ginger, Jorge, Blake, and Noah, who's a longtime supporter who recently came back as a Patreon supporter, as well as Francis, who donated to the show through PayPal. Also, I wanted to highlight a message I got a little while ago from Chris that, Jay, you'll appreciate this. I think it really goes to the heart of, you know, what we try to do here on the show. And Chris wrote, Mike, I disagree with almost everything you say, but I'm definitely challenged by it. And from time to time, it has definitely popped my bubble. And that was a really nice thing to hear, you know?
Yeah,
I really appreciated that. Thank you, Chris, for that message. And also, finally, I wanted to let folks know that although we haven't had ads on the show in a while now, we recently entered into an agreement with a new hosting platform, and so before long, we expect there will be some short commercial breaks here and there. And of course, if you're one of our Patreon supporters, you don't only get that second full-length episode every week, you also get ad-free versions of all of our shows, as well as various other things at different levels of support. And of course, to check that out, you know where to go, patreon.com/politicsguys, and the links in the show notes every week.
We're reopening the economy.
There you go. There you go. And of course, as I mentioned briefly, if a monthly pledge of support, not really your thing, too much of a commitment, you can do that through PayPal as well. And again, politicsguys.com/support, and you'll see the PayPal link there as well. And of course, if you would like all the bonus content, all that stuff, but you're just not in a position where that's financially feasible for you right now, just send me a quick email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up with all of that stuff. Here we go. You know, we'll start with this week, the House of Representatives passing legislation in response to the nationwide call for police reform. It's fairly bipartisan in the wake of the George Floyd killing. Now, the Republican-controlled Senate also introduced legislation, but that was stopped prior to floor action by a Democratic filibuster. And while there does, as I mentioned, seem to be some bipartisan agreement, at least on elements, things like better data collection, barring chokeholds, making lynching a federal hate crime, the House version is much more expansive than the Senate-proposed version and includes one measure that Republicans say is essentially a non-starter, and that's ending qualified immunity for law enforcement officers. And of course, as you would expect, given the times we're living in, both the House and the Senate versions were designed by the majority party with essentially no input from the minority. So, Jay, what do you think about this? I mean, do you expect to see something pass Congress this year? And if you do, what do you think it might contain?
No, I don't expect anything to pass Congress.
Okay.
I mean, I think at this point we are too close to an election, and both parties are going to want to campaign on their version and the intransigence of the other side. I mean, I think that's just the way it's set up.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that says a little bit about how seriously the people who claim to be taking these issues seriously are, right?
On both sides, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, on both sides. And this is very much, you know, a couple of years ago, there was sort of a similar situation with DACA. There were broad issues, broad places where you could have had agreements on immigration.
Yep.
For things like the Dreamers. But it really worked to the advantage of both sides to simply, you know, it's better to have the issue than to have the solution.
Yeah, it's at both sides essentially saying, hey, I'd love to help out people in a bad situation, but, you know, honestly, I have to get reelected. That's more important. And that's what we're hearing, unfortunately.
I mean, well, that's the other thing. That's not to say that there isn't a substantive difference.
Sure.
There. And I'm, you know, if it were me, and it, of course it's not me, I think you could find some pretty reasonable ground to compromise there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there could be a you know, a paring back of qualified immunity. And besides, in a lot of ways that so often qualified immunity issues are handled at a state level, and you have, I mean, there's ways to get it done, but I don't expect that it's in the electoral interests of either side to get it done.
And just like, you know, actually, I prefer the Republican Senate plan idea for instance, limiting and requiring greater transparency in no-knock warrants as opposed to just an outright ban. And so I think those are two examples. Like, well, we'll give a little on the no-knock, but you need to give us a little bit on the qualified immunity. And if they were seriously considering getting something done, there would be that kind of legislative horse trading. But as you said, you know, this close before an election, even in normal times, it would be difficult to see anything, but with such a highly charged issue that's going to be a strong election issue for both parties, it's just hard to see it. And I think especially, I would argue, for my party, because I think Democrats are looking at the polls and, you know, hoping that and feel that there's a reasonable chance that the legislative environment's going to be more favorable for them. And the calculation on a number of levels as well, maybe we wait 7 months and we're going to be able to get much more of what we want as opposed to just sort of settling. And they can also say, well, and it's not like nothing is happening, because as you pointed out, you know, there are things that are happening at the state and local level right now in a number of places. And so to me, just not even on a craven sort of political, but even just for a substantive standpoint, I think it's actually better for Democrats not to bend, given how close we are to an election.
Yeah, no, I a couple things. One, here's, I think there's going to be, as the summer rolls on, calls for the Democrats to go even further, right?
It's possible, sure.
And that may be an issue that they run into with getting their base out. But I want to get your thoughts on the filibuster to prevent debate on the Republican bill.
I mean,
you know, look, you can argue, you can say, look, I think the House version is better. But, you know, typically the filibuster is used for that sort of, I don't want to say nuclear option because that's something kind of different, but it is in you know, to block sort of something that is egregious. The big fight, this is, and look, here's something we can all agree on. And there would also be a mechanism, albeit not a sure mechanism, but certainly a mechanism to amend the Senate bill as debate continued. So, I mean, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have all the information we would like to have, because this is sort of a more procedural type of thing. But the majority leader, majority party basically controls the extent to which amendments can be offered and who can offer them. And we won't get into the whole filling the amendment tree and all this kind of arcane stuff. But there were some behind the scenes negotiations, and the Senate Republican leadership promised Democrats that if they didn't filibuster, they'd get votes on X number of amendments, and the Democrats came back with, well, no, we want votes on more than X plus two or X plus three or what have you, you know. And so there was that element of it. But again, I think more generally, the Senate Democrats felt that it just made much more sense substantively and politically to stop it right here. Though, if I were a Democratic senator, I probably would have felt I would have felt compelled to vote along with my fellow Democrats Joe Manchin and Doug Jones, as well as with Angus King, who's an independent, but you know, he caucuses with the Democrats, to actually invoke cloture and have a debate on the Senate floor. So I understand.
Good for you.
Well, I understand the reason for it, but I think I would have liked to have seen a debate actually on the Senate floor about that.
Yeah. You know?
And I think my sense is that I would expect that this is going to be one of the top two issues that Joe Biden campaigns on, you know, sort of once I mandate everyone have masks, and we'll maybe talk about that later. But that comprehensive policing reform will be my first or second legislative priority. And I think that will be, you know, certainly a big issue.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on then to something that actually a story that broke just a little bit too late for Trey and Ken to discuss last week. And that is Attorney General William Barr announcing the resignation of Jeffrey Berman, a U.S. attorney for Southern District of New York. And of course, as everyone knows at this point, Berman responded by saying, in effect, nope, I'm actually not resigning, and which then led Barr to tell him, well, in that case, President Trump is firing you. The fact of which President Trump seemed unaware when he initially told reporters that he wasn't involved. Now, no reason was given for the firing, though it's been suggested that either the Attorney General or President Trump might have done so to put a stop to investigations Berman's office is conducting related to Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani and some other weird stuff involving Turkey and all kinds of things like that. And of course, that's led to calls from the Democrats, from Barr, to explain why Berman was fired. And, you know, some on the left are even going so far as saying that Barr should be impeached, which seems basically it's not going to happen given how close we are to a presidential election and what Democrats hope will be a new administration in 2021 that will, you know, take care of all of this. So, Jay, what do you think about all this?
Well, I think there's a bunch of things going on, and there was also the news, or at least has been reported, that, you know, what happened was the administration wanted to replace Berman with Jay Clayton, who was the chairman of the SEC, and Berman was offered the chairmanship of the SEC, which isn't a bad job, really. It's not as if he were going to be demoted to, you know, the guy cleaning the restrooms at the Department of Justice. And he declined. And then we ended up, you know, the typical language they use to protect everyone's ego and just the genteelness that you know, you would expect to operate at that level. They would say, well, he's decided to resign. And then he said, no, I have not. And so I guess I'm looking at that, and my, to the extent that there's a conspiracy theory to say we're going to get rid of him to stop the investigations, I don't think that's I don't think that's viable, right? Because the first question, what you get when you, if you were to do something like that, the first question the new guy gets when he takes the job is, are you going to continue the investigation? And I think the response is, well, yeah, and you know, you're not just gonna drop it. So I'm worried that the conspiracy theories, and also I think there were a lot of conservatives, a lot of people in general, who see this as another example of sort of the swamp, so to speak, where you have, you know, someone who was an appointed federal employee. Who sort of sees this as life tenure, right? No, you can't fire me. I'm not resigning. I'm staying. And sort of similar to like a Sally Yates situation where, no, I'm not going to do what you tell me, but nor will I resign. And there have been a number of these situations. And
but let's be clear, this is a little bit different because no one except for a few kind of people way out on the edges are arguing that a U.S. attorney can't be fired by the president. This is more of an issue of where Attorney General Barr, I think, screwed up by not making sure that Berman was okay with this job swap sort of thing. And then he released a statement just assuming that that would be okay. So I see this really
I think that Berman played him.
Yeah, I'm sure that's possible
that way,
too.
Right. That, you know, I would hope that Barr would be, because again, this is something that I lament all the time, is that Republicans are terrible at this inside baseball kind of stuff.
Oh, I think you, I think they're great at it. They're just as good. I think I think you are underestimating the inside baseball acumen of your own party. There are just as many swamp creatures on the right as there are on the left. Exhibit A, Mitch McConnell would be a great one. So no, I think that's a very disingenuous. You might want to think that, but that's just
not
the
disingenuous.
Case.
I mean, you actually believe
it. That's right. Okay, fair enough.
My team is not good at this.
No, your team is very good at this. No, I disagree with that entirely. But
if they were good, I think what you would have had would have been a situation where you had enough of a paper trail of this before moving on it, right? So that when Berman then came out and said, "No, I didn't resign," then you say, "Well, wait a minute. Here's your email where you agreed that you're resigning," or that sort of thing.
Okay, yeah,
right?
Okay, sure. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Well, what's weird to me, Jay, is that it sounds to me like, and I agree with you in substance on what's going on here. It seems to me that the most likely thing is Jay Clayton was golfing with Donald Trump and said, "Hey, you know, I'd really like to be the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York." And Donald Trump said, "Oh, sure, let's do that." Because it's not like Berman is some far left kind of person. He's a Trump, you know, he's a Trump guy and that sort of thing. He's not.
He was appointed sort of interim, by the court rather than by the administration to fill a vacancy.
Right, but he's a supporter of the president. And it seems to me that really it's weird too, because it's really unlikely that Clayton's going to be confirmed, because Lindsey Graham, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said that he plans to honor the blue slip practice, which means that either of the senators in that state where the U.S. attorney would serve have a de facto veto. And those senators are, you know, Chuck Schumer and Amy Klobuchar. And I would assume both of them are not going to return their blue slips. And so it's kind of a weird thing. It just wasn't, I guess in that sense, I do, now that I'm thinking about it, I am agreeing with you in this instance, because as long as Berman would have gone along, and they would have talked with Schumer and Klobuchar and gotten everyone on board, then there could have been just this sort of job swap type of thing. Right. But they really kind of messed this up in a big way. It kind of has the Keystone Cops quality to it.
Yeah. Well, and look, the other thing is, if this were some plot to punish Berman or to get rid of him, I mean, you know, look, we'll fix him. We'll make him the chairman of the SEC. It's sort of, you know, you're still placing him in a very powerful position. In fact, I would argue sort of a more powerful position, because that would be an appointed, I believe, an appointed term, and he couldn't be removed by an incoming administration. That's to me, this looks as a sort of, media blow up of something that's just kind of, you know, the typical HR issue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything deep and dark here. I just think that the Trump administration, well, in this case, I initially disagree with you, but we're
terrible at the inside baseball.
No, I don't think it's inside baseball. It's just basic competence. I mean, you can call it inside baseball, but before you announce a move like this, it's just a basic element of competence to make sure that everyone's on board, that it doesn't blow up in your face. And that wasn't done. So I just see that as a lack of competence.
I would argue that maybe there was it had been worked out before, but they had not committed it to writing, which is the problem.
But do you think or other
evidence? Yeah.
Well, but the president probably should have been aware that he actually fired Berman instead he said he wasn't involved, which is, I would suggest, that's a competence issue.
Both could be true.
So in other words, the president doesn't necessarily know that his attorney general fired the most powerful U.S. attorney, the most important U.S. attorney in the country. That seems to me to be a little bit of a problem.
He could say, I think the president could credibly say, again, depends on what the question is and how he answered it exactly. And I don't have the transcript in front of him. But I mean, could you say, did you fire him? Were you involved in firing him? you could say, well, no. I mean, you know, you could say, like, look, I thought he was resigning to take an SEC position. And then it may have been that Barr, you know, went ahead and dropped the bomb without Trump signing off on it.
But of course, that isn't possible because the attorney general can't fire U.S. attorneys. Only the president can.
Well, you know.
No, the president actually.
I guess you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, but anyway, okay. It seems like on the most important issue, I guess what I would argue the most important issue, is there some sort of big conspiracy here? You seem to think it's essentially no, not at all. And I seem to think it's unlikely. So we're largely in agreement on that, I think.
Right. But would you agree, though? And this isn't a partisan thing, that there is incumbent upon public officials who serve at the pleasure of the president to have more of a graciousness in leaving office.
I think it depends. I think if they feel like they are being forced out for reasons they disagree with, I think it's absolutely okay for them to require that the president relieve them. And that's their choice, but that option has to be made to them. And so I think the proper thing to do is for the president or the appropriate official to go to the official and say, listen, we want to make a personnel move. And this can be either you are resigning to spend more time with your family or take another position,
right,
or we're firing you. Which would it be? And you propose the idea that maybe Barr was played by Berman. And that's certainly possible, but it's also just as possible that Barr didn't confirm that Berman was absolutely okay with it. We just don't know.
Sure.
So, but generally speaking, if the person is offered that option, yeah, it's better for them to be gracious if they feel that, you know, they want to not disrupt the administration or make the administration look bad. Sure. Absolutely. Okay. Let's move on here then to something that maybe we'll have a little bit less agreement on. Let's see. But in a 2-1 decision this week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia ordered Federal District Judge Emmett Sullivan to, well, accede to the Justice Department's request to dismiss the criminal case against former Trump administration National Security Advisor. Well, it's weird to even say that because for 22 days, but Michael Flynn.
Exactly.
Now, the decision written by Trump-appointed Judge Naomi Rao said that it wasn't Sullivan's place to examine the government's motives. And in the decision, Rao wrote, each of our three co-equal branches should be encouraged to self-correct when it errs. If evidence comes to light calling into question the integrity or purpose of an underlying criminal investigation, the executive branch must have the authority to decide that further prosecution is not in the interest of justice. Now, writing in dissent, Obama appointee Robert Wilkins said that the appeals court had grievously overstepped its authority by granting mandamus relief before Sullivan had the opportunity to rule. And the ruling was really something of a surprise because during oral arguments, two of the three judges on the panel, and they're selected randomly, seemed to be inclined to wait until Sullivan had ruled before taking any action. Now, any active judge on the D.C. Circuit can request that the case be heard en banc by all of the judges on the circuit. And my guess is that that's pretty likely because Judge Wilkins clearly feels this was a highly misguided decision. And also, Democrat-appointed judges have a 7-5 majority on the court. So I don't think we've heard the last of this at the D.C. Circuit level, but we will see. So, Jay, what do you think about this decision?
Well, that could be. First of all, I think it's fantastic. I think it's the right decision. The issue, and look, I would admit this is sort of a close issue, is more on the timing of it. Is this remedy ripe at this point for the court to step in and say, I'm a believer in judicial humility judicial non-activism. So to some extent, look, the idea of ordering a mandamus to an inferior judge, that's a difficult question.
That question
is not bound up though in the guilt or innocence of Michael Flynn,
right?
Or whether the government acted improperly.
Right. Yeah.
I think you can say, yes, the government acted improperly. Michael Flynn is not guilty. This should happen. The only question is, do we need to wait for Justice Sullivan to issue a formal order saying, I am not accepting the motion to dismiss? Now, at the same time, the argument from the majority, which, look, if you're going to overcome one of these mandamus type argument, or this high bar that you have to get over for a mandamus, you know, the tension seems to go on what is it that they are essentially enjoining with the mandamus. And again, a mandamus isn't, it's not you're stopping something, but it can be phrased in the negative, right? You're ordering someone to do something that they have a duty to do. And according to the majority, said the problem isn't that, you know, that Judge Sullivan has done something affirmatively that is outside his power, and that was naming former Judge Gleason as essentially the new prosecutor to determine whether new charges ought to be brought or whether the motion ought to be granted. And the majority said, look, that's clearly outside the judiciary power. The sort of second guess the government, the federal prosecution, the executive, and that there could be exceptions, but this doesn't fit into one of them. And I think there very much is this interest in self-correcting, right? So
sure.
Look, I think it was a pretty close call.
See,
whether the D.C. Circuit takes it up en banc, I mean, maybe. To the extent they do, and they overturn it, then it's probably
I don't think it was very close because of the timing issue. I mean, even Judge Henderson, who joined in the majority here, back in 2015, she wrote, "Mandamus is inappropriate in the presence of an obvious means of review, direct appeal from final judgment." And so that's perfectly on point. There is still Judge Sullivan hasn't rendered his final judgment, and so mandamus is inappropriate here. And what struck me is in the majority opinion, the court seemed to be arguing that the relief here wasn't being granted for the sake of the petitioner, who's Flynn, but rather for the government government would suffer irreparable harm if forced to explain its motives. And well, we can argue about whether or not that's true or false. I disagree because I think courts are asked the government to explain its motives all the time. The travel ban cases would be an example, but more.
I would say that I think the government did explain its motives in the motion to dismiss.
Okay. Well,
there was evidence that was improperly exculpatory evidence that was improperly withheld. The investigation was not properly premised. There is no basis on any of the information that they have to make out the elements of the crime for which he pled.
Okay. And
that's their justification. Now, if you want to say, well, that's not your real justification, well, okay. But is it the place of the trial court to do that?
Yeah. And I think the benefit of the doubt, and you and I agree on this, has to go with assuming good intentions on the part of the administration is acting in good faith. Although I think everyone would say this is a very unusual case, unusual circumstance. And so I think it's a close call whether or not, you know, Judge Sullivan made the right move or not. But again, the bigger thing to me is the timing. And here specifically, I think what it seems to me that the majority here is saying is, well, Flynn is asking for this relief, this mandamus, but he clearly, as a matter of law, that's not something we really can give to him before a final, but there's another means of redressing this, a means of review, and there is, but we feel like we should give relief to the government, which didn't actually ask for it. And so my initial thought was, wow, that's about as sweeping a judicial activism as you get, giving relief to a party that hasn't even requested it, and essentially creating a petitioner where none exists. And so that just sort of blew my mind that the court just could have waited, and you mentioned this before, just could have waited until Sullivan ruled. And then I think a lot of these issues would have gone away, and I would have agreed with you then that it would have been a much closer issue. But here, I think the majority was just wrong, if for no other reason that they acted prematurely to stop this. And I think that was just clearly, as a matter of law, inappropriate. And that's
well, there's why. Also, I mean, the majority relied on a case that's delightfully named Fokker. so there's so you can get all kinds of fun with that. But you know, and according to that, it is that there is. Look, whether the government asked for it or not, Flynn asked for it, so that puts the issue in play. And I get your point saying this is the party did not request it, although you could say, look, they requested it in their initial motion to dismiss, which is what is being challenged. You know, it's sort of the same party, you know, a party on the same side has raised the issue. So, but I think there's, look, this is a close call, but would you agree that let me take that back. Yeah, I'm not going to go there today.
Well, I think, and again,
but I think, look, because I think we're on the same page that the government has prosecutorial discretion and has a duty to correct its mistakes.
Yeah.
And to say that the trial court can then second guess that. It also came down a lot to, again, this is kind of technical in the weeds, but criminal rule 48, which is, you know, says that listen, for a dismissal, you know, it has to be approved by the court.
Right.
And the discussion ranged on, so to what extent does the court then, you know, have to hold a hearing? Is this a rubber stamp situation where the court simply, if someone does it, the court approves it? Or how big of an inquiry does the court have to hold in approving a motion to dismiss by the prosecution?
And as
you might expect, there's probably not a ton of case law out there on this, because it doesn't happen that often.
Right.
I mean, where the prosecution says, okay, never mind, we're going to drop the charges, and the court says, whoa, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird situation, and
as you pointed out, Jay,
this is a tough one for me, because again, I would agree, mandamus on a judge, and the other piece of this is mandamus is typically reserved for acts that are ministerial, mm-hmm. In nature, right? That it's sort of okay, county clerk of courts, issue me my marriage license,
right,
where there is no.
There's a clear official duty that you're not performing that you need to perform.
The official duty that is plain, and here's what you got to do. And the statute says, you know, you shall do X, Y, and Z. It is typically not used in a situation where there's any type of discretion. And in this case, a judge is sort of by definition, an official who exercises his discretion on issues. So,
And, you know, I think, Jay, a part of the problem here is that, and you mentioned this earlier, that this is, I don't want to diminish it by calling it a technical thing, because I think judicial activism isn't a technical thing. It's very important. But you can feel, and I have some sympathy, a lot of sympathy for this view, that Michael Flynn was treated poorly, and you can make a case that he never should have been charged in the first place. And I think there's a good argument, a very good argument to be made for that, despite how sleazy a person I think he may be. That has no bearing on whether or not he should be treated fairly by the FBI, right? We've talked about this before. And so when you see a decision that gives you the decision that you feel is a just decision, but the means to that end seem to be improper judicial activism, that can create an understandable tension, I think, to a lot of people who feel that Michael Flynn was railroaded.
Yeah. I'm big enough to admit that that to me this is well, I won't say it's as egregious as a same-sex marriage decision or something like that, which again, look, I agreed with the policy result. But I didn't see any constitutional basis of how the court got there.
Yeah.
Likewise, the recent what's his name? the LGBT protections in the
Sure.
You know, again, I think that's a good idea as policy. But if that's the case, well, let's go ahead and amend the act and put it in there. So this I would say is not as egregiously activist as that, because it's not really reinterpreting statute or making up new rights, but it is an expansive view of a court's power to order mandamus. That said, it's also done in really sort of an extraordinary context.
Yeah.
Where there's not much guidance there anyway, because this kind of stuff never happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it turns out in the end, though, actually, I think that you and I agree.
Except the Mr. Focker.
Yeah. you and I actually agree a little more than I thought we maybe would. But I guess that's not really surprising, because we're neither of us big fans of judicial activism, even when it
even when it
ends up with outcomes that we tend to prefer. So there you go. Okay, let's see here. Moving on, let's talk a little bit about immigration, because of course, early this week, I think we might agree a fair amount on this. We'll see, but early this week, President Trump issued a proclamation that bars multiple categories of foreign workers from coming to the U.S., as well as limiting immigration visas, citing the need to protect U.S. citizens from job losses due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the order, which will not apply to foreign workers already on U.S. soil, has been pretty sharply criticized by the business community, which argues that in many of the affected categories, unemployment is still very low, and that restricting foreign workers in these areas is not only going to make economic recovery more difficult, but it's also going to give an advantage to countries like China, for instance, who will allow these workers in. Now, I should point out that the order excludes agricultural laborers, healthcare professionals who are supporting pandemic response, and food service employees, and it's also subject to review and modification every 60 days. So, Jay, my question after I read that was, do you stand with the Wall Street Journal editorial board and the Chamber of Congress or Chamber of Commerce on this, or are you with President Trump?
Well, I think that's sort of an easy one for
it
me.
It answers itself, I think, almost.
I think that the order is unneeded and likely counterproductive for all those reasons that you just named. Now, the idea that these workers will go to China instead, I think that's maybe overselling it a bit. The idea of, well, here's my option. I've got this one potential job in the U.S. where I'll be highly paid and a great free society, or I can go to Totalitarian.
That's a good point. That's a good point. You know? Absolutely.
I'm not sure I think that may be sort of a false choice there.
Now, they could go other places, like say, well, I got a job in London, maybe, or something like that. Like, oh, that's nice. Yeah. And I should point out that these visas we're talking about, and this is what the tech community has been kind of up in arms about, the H-1B visas. Now, these are capped at $85,000 a year. Most of them tend to be for computer programming. And to give you a sense, the unemployment rate for these occupations in that general category in May of this year was 2.5%. Actually, the Labor Department has a survey called the JOLTS survey that found that there were a little over 122,000 information industry jobs openings in April. And that was actually slightly more than the year before. So this is not an area that's particularly hurting at all because of the pandemic.
Right. And it's not an area where there have been somehow U.S. workers are being replaced by cheaper foreign workers.
Yeah, that's another good point. I wanted to thank you for mentioning that.
Bringing highly skilled people in, and we're bringing them in because they're highly skilled, not because they're cheaper.
Yeah. And you know, that's one of the other categories of visas that's being affected by this H-2B. That's for seasonal guest workers. Now, those are capped at $66,000 each year, but businesses, before they can get a visa on that, they have to show that they tried to hire American workers before applying, and they also have to pay at least the market prevailing wage. So,
right. Now, I think that portion is much more defensible. I'm still not crazy about it, but I think you could say that makes a little more sense, because the idea that you would have lower skilled workers, Americans who could perform these jobs, but are not. You know, I think that there's a defensible argument there.
Well, I'm still not for it. Well, I guess I'm a little unclear on that, because it seems to me that if, as is the case in law, a requirement for the H-2B visa is that a business is applying for that have to demonstrate they tried to hire an American worker first, and if they hire a foreign worker, they have to pay at least that prevailing wage, then it seems to me limiting or banning H-2B visas doesn't really have any effect, because it wouldn't have a downward effect on jobs. It wouldn't have an effect on not hiring Americans, because to even get that visa, you have to demonstrate that stuff. So I don't understand why the H-2B visas were included in that order by the president.
Oh, I misspoke then. Yeah, I meant that the provisions on the H-2B visas that you went through, that makes
right.
them
okay, gotcha.
More yeah. defensible. Yeah. yeah.
So I guess you see this more as just the president kind of being, I don't even want to call it playing to his base, to kind of helping to support the anti-immigration or the immigration restriction folks, I guess you could say. But it seems to be kind of an odd move. Clearly it doesn't seem like the right policy move. Both you and I agree on that. Do you think it makes sense for the president politically to do this?
You know, probably. I mean, again, it's he can say to his base, "Hey, look, we're in times of great economic turmoil," and the basic argument would be. And keep in mind, you know, you never, even if you're Trump, you never operate in a vacuum. You know, there will be people out there on the right and on the left who will argue, this is ridiculous. This is the highest unemployment rate we've had since the Great Depression. And here we are bringing in people
right.
from foreign
sure.
countries to take American jobs. Now, look, that's demagoguery, but it's out there.
And
you can be exposed on both sides. So, yeah, you say this is my insurance policy, and saying, no, I am not in this time of great economic crisis. Referring foreign workers or allowing foreign workers to come in and take American jobs.
Yeah.
Look, as a policy point, I think it's wrong for the reasons we just went through, that these are not taking American jobs, and they're likely to make American companies more productive, which will mean a greater economy and more Americans getting hired across the board.
Right.
But you know, the other thing is that doesn't happen all at once, and it's difficult to trace, to say our increase in productivity is from these
sure.
you know, these H-1B.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So you know, look, on balance, I'm for bringing all the talent in the world. You know, welcome to America,
yeah.
right? And I think this moves against it. So
yeah.
I stand with the Wall Street Journal editorial board.
There you go.
And the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
I do
like,
too.
I was recently sworn in as a board of directors member for the Lakewood Chamber of
there
Commerce.
There you go. Well, you know. So yeah,
and although I'm not taking a position for the Lakewood Chamber of Commerce,
right?
I will stand obviously with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Although I would predict they would probably take the same position.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we actually have time for one more story, and I think that's a good thing, because it's a pretty important story, because as states have opened up, we've now started to see really pretty significant increases in COVID-19 cases, reported positive cases. In fact, the U.S. set a record this week for the number of daily cases. Now, as President Trump has repeatedly pointed out, more testing does mean more positive cases will be reported, but what the president maybe hasn't focused on is that the percentage of tests coming back positive is also sharply on the rise in many states.
Right.
But
although it's interesting in some states more than others.
Yeah, in some states more than others.
For example, I mean, Ohio has stayed pretty much flat
yeah.
at about a 4 or 5% positive rate throughout.
Right. And Ohio, I think, has gone up a little bit recently, certainly. And there are some hot spots, in fact, in my area. But yeah,
right.
but I guess, you know, a lot of this, the lack of a corresponding rise in death rates is being attributed in large part to the larger number of young people who are now testing positive, but also to the healthcare profession having more knowledge, better treatment, that sort of thing. But it, you know, certainly it has been a big issue. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has announced that the state's going to pause its reopening efforts. There was an announcement, I think, just yesterday that they were going to be shutting down bars, which makes sense, you know. But Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis told reporters on Friday that nothing has changed in the last week, and that the surge was the result of a test dump, as he put it, which seems peculiar to me because Florida is one of those cases where it's not just the positive cases are up, but actually the positive rate recently hit just over 14%, which is, I think, by anyone's standards, alarming. And in fact, that's higher than Florida has been at any point, even in the, you know, the what we considered the height of this. And so, Jay, I wanted to get your thoughts on it because it certainly looks to me like many of the current hotspots are in, you know, those Sun Belt states where they tend to have Republican governors who are maybe a little more reluctant to shut down, maybe a little more reluctant to or a little more eager to open up. And so what do you think, you know, going on here about the response and what you see happening?
Well, I think let's continue to look at the numbers here. Yeah. I think there's a couple things that are interesting about this. One is it seems to be a lot more young people who are being infected. In some ways, that's kind of a good news, bad news situation.
Yeah.
And it's bad news in that more people are being infected. It's good news in that they are typically younger who seem to have, many fewer complications and in many cases recover quickly, which means, hey, look, we have young people who are catching colds and it increases our herd immunity. Downside would be, of course, if they visit grandma in the nursing home, type situation. The other sort of good news, I think, is if you can trace it to young people and bars in particular, it seems that, look, this is the issue that is kind of happening. It is this congregating indoors, which raises another question. And I'll say this is completely unscientific because because I am not a scientist, despite what most people think.
You don't even play one on the internet now.
My vast knowledge. But I think another commonality of a lot of these southern states, besides Republican governors, is it gets really hot and they have air conditioning. And there is more of an incentive to be inside in congregate settings, in your bars, restaurants, et cetera, as we move into the summer in these places. Than there is other places in the country.
Yeah.
So well, I mean, I think there's a variety of factors there.
But you look at
states in the Midwest and the Northeast, and they haven't seen that same jump. And I think part of it is maybe it's a slower reopening. Maybe it is there is just less southern rebelliousness up here, and more people wearing masks, more people social distancing, that sort of thing. Just as a cultural thing, and actually, I think it's funny. My daughter, we live in Cleveland. You live in Cincinnati. My wife's parents are from Cincinnati. My daughter went and spent a week with them last week, and noted the incredible difference in amount of social distancing and mask wearing between Cleveland and Cincinnati.
There's a lot less of it here than there is up in Cleveland. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And again, we have the same governor, we have the same regulations, and it is just more sort of a cultural.
And we're also a hotspot now here in southern Ohio.
Right,
so,
exactly.
And, I wanted to talk about that issue because it was interesting to me. There are currently 15 states that mandate masks for citizens when out in public. And of those 15 states, 10 aren't seeing an increase in new cases, and 4 are actually seeing a decrease. And breaking it down even further, of the 5 that are seeing an increase of that 15, 3 have only put their mandatory mask requirement in place in the last couple of weeks or less. So, yeah. I mean, I agree with Marco Rubio, who said everyone should just wear a damn mask.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's pretty clear. And again, you know, I've been frustrated for a long time about this. I feel like you can certainly argue that people sometimes make the mask a political statement, but certainly I believe that the president has gone too far the other way and stress too much the voluntary, and it's, you know, the old masks are a double-edged sword and that sort of thing. I really feel like this is a lost opportunity to not only express leadership and bring people together, but also to save some lives that President Trump hasn't taken for, you know, reasons of his own.
Sure. Now, there's a bit of an irony here in that, you know, well, I think in some cases you say, well, a lot of these states just required masks recently. Does the requirement follow the culture or the culture of the requirement?
Yeah,
right?
That's a good question. Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, as you said, a lot of these states did not have significant upticks recently. So they're probably wearing masks. And like I said, a lot of more people in my neck of the woods are wearing masks than in your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
And we're in the same state and we have the same governor and we have the same laws upon us. And there is the question of if the governor did require wearing masks, which I oppose just because it's the government kind of getting up in your business, right? You know, would those you rebellious Southerners in the Queen City, you know, would you abide by it?
Sure. Well, I think
and this is the next question. If you didn't abide by it, what would happen?
Yeah, absolutely.
And to me, I mean, we're also in the midst of this conversation about, well, we need less policing. We need the police to do less. We need, you know, the government to be out of our business. And the reason we have, you know, some of these conflicts is because we have police injecting themselves in the situations that maybe they don't need to be in. But when you pass another requirement, look, you're either going to enforce it or you're not. So that's why I'm for the very Burkean individual. Hey, look, do this out of the sense of community good, and because it's the common sense thing to do, as opposed to this would be better if the government required it.
Yeah, I only wish that the president were able to express that half as well as you expressed that, and I think we'd be in a lot better position.
Yeah, well, everybody'd be in a better position
yeah.
without the president, but yeah. That's, you know, that's another story altogether.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And so now, kind of related to this, and I think I teased it, hinted at it earlier on, but Joe Biden said that if he were president, he would make mask wearing mandatory. And my first thought was, I don't know that you actually have the constitutional authority to do that. In fact, I'm pretty sure that you don't. And again, that to me, it's frustrating because I think as a matter of science and public health, even though I am not a scientist either, it seems pretty clear that there's a consensus that yes, this is something everyone should be doing. And yet I don't necessarily think that Joe Biden saying that was helpful at all, because it's going to make Donald Trump, it's going to make everyone on the other side.
Yes, that was an in-kind contribution to the Trump campaign.
So I mean, it doesn't help things, and so I think a better statement is just, you know, showing up in public in mask and urging people, and so I understand why he said that, but you know, I have issues with executive power as you do as well, and so I sort of disagree with that, and it's just as a matter of law, I don't think it's something that he could actually do.
There's a fundamental difference sometimes that I see between the right and left, and fortunately you do not fall victim to this.
Good.
You know, really because of your other background and probably your association with me, I suppose.
Oh yeah.
but no, there's a view that often on the left that if something is good, then it ought to be required.
Right.
And I, you know, so many other folks chafe at that, or Republicans chafe at that, and we get this pushback about, well, why don't you care? Why don't you save lives? Look, there are probably millions of lives that could be saved every year if people ate more vegetables.
Oh, yeah.
And exercised. And look, it's certainly a good thing to eat more vegetables and to get more exercise. It is totally right and proper that the government ought to encourage that. But that does not mean by any stretch of the imagination that the government should, even if it had the authority, mandate vegetable eating and exercise. And I think that's sort of where we are with masks. And I would even make the argument, and this is maybe getting a little more philosophical, but if your goal is to have a better society, a evolving society for the good, aren't you aren't you a better society if you have everyone does this voluntarily yeah. out of concern for their human yeah. being rather their fellow humans rather than because, well, otherwise I'm going to get a ticket.
Yeah. And this is a very Burkean thing. We both believe that that culture is much more powerful and politics is very far yeah. downstream exactly. of culture. So, yeah, I totally agree. And I understand that that feeling because, as you know, you've known me forever, that I am quite a contrary. And if someone tells me to do something, my, you know, a good part of my teen years were my mom telling me to do things and me saying, I'll show you. I'll do my best to destroy my life just despite you if you're telling me to yeah. do this thing. You know.
It also avoids the one size fits all rule,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Because look, there probably are people who, for one reason or another, can't wear a mask, shouldn't wear a mask,
yeah,
have real issues with wearing a mask. Yeah. So let's, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
again,
let
that go on a case by case basis and let their own conscience be their guide.
I would say to both sides, don't think of a mask as a political statement either way. You know, just think of it as doing something decent for your, you know, for your fellow citizens, basically, you know. Yeah. And if you want to make a political statement with your mask, you can get I'm sure you can get a MAGA mask or, you know, you can get a Biden 2020 mask or whatever you want. I have one with dog paws on it that my mother-in-law made for me. And there's my political statement, pro dog. So there you go.
Hey, I have one. No, just an interesting point.
Yeah.
I know we're right, but look, you know, I am sort of an old soul, and
oh, yeah.
for most of my entertainment, the only television channel I tend to watch regularly is Turner Classic Movies. And there was a movie on a couple weeks ago, and I even forget what it was, but it's set in post-war Japan. And there was just this random crowd scene, right? And there were all these people wearing masks. And it just struck me as like, wow, this is something that in Asian cultures,
yeah.
this has been going on
yep.
for, you know, again, this 60 some years. And it was just, you know, a random street scene of here's a guy on his bike riding by wearing a mask. That just struck me as interesting.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's a great point. It kind of reinforces what we were saying about, you know, cultural, if you can achieve things through kind of cultural pressure, if you will, or cultural norms, that's way better than doing it through legislation. You and I are in complete agreement on that. Hey, you know, before we do leave, we have a tiny bit of time. And so let's do our weekly recommendations. I wanted to start with something kind of fun this week, very different. My recommendation this week is going to be a font, of all things, a computer font that made the news this week because Goldman Sachs, the finance corporation, has released this week its very own font. They call it a clean, modern typeface designed for the needs of digital finance that's neutral with a wink. And it's very nice. I downloaded it. It actually works very well in the spreadsheet, as you would expect from a Goldman Sachs font. But the interesting thing about it, it's called Goldman San, is, as somebody pointed out, who actually read that license, the user agreement that comes along with it. Two things that are kind of interesting in it. First off is a provision that says the user may not use the licensed font software to disparage or suggest any affiliation or endorsement by Goldman Sachs. So you can't say bad things about Goldman Sachs, which once again, with there's the my font. Contrary nature. Of course, you know, the first thing I did was pulled up right. the font and said Goldman Sachs sucks because how could you not do that, right? Duh. But then secondly, there's a part in the license that says Goldman Sachs may terminate this license without notice to the user for any reason or no reason at all and at any time completely at Goldman Sachs' sole discretion. And I thought, wow, way to go, Goldman legal department. You really stepped in it there. And it just kind of reminded me, I think, a lot of people of that great description one time of Goldman Sachs by Matt Taibbi, a political journalist who called them a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. But Goldman Sachs, what were you thinking about? Anyway, if you ever wanted something for nothing from Goldman Sachs and you want to just, you know, but understand.
Although they can revoke your right to use the font.
For any reason or no reason at all. In fact, why are we revoking it? No reason at all. We just, yeah.
Stop using that font.
Anyway, I thought that was fun. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but I thought that was kind of fun. So, Jay, do you have anything for us this week?
Well, I do. And, you know, mine's maybe a little more serious. You and I talked about this. So, Kevin Williamson piece in National Review. from a week or so ago. Just again, I'm not even saying it makes a point, but it does, and it's really well written. It's really powerful, I think. And it goes to what are we really doing about racial inequality or policing issues, and it points out that, you know, sort of there are so many things that are being done that are symbolic and to some extent meaningless and virtue signaling, and yet the same people remain in charge of the police departments that were in charge before. You know, nothing has really changed, and this doesn't change the equation. So I would encourage people to read that. It's less of a, because we had a pretty lighthearted, agreement filled show today.
Yeah, I think that's why we got this so much, because we were agreeing on so many things. Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, that is you sent that to me earlier in the week, and that's very good.
You and I necessarily disagree about, but it's sort of just a, yeah. You know, you're going to read it, and you will be probably angered a little bit.
Well, I think that though,
regardless of where you're coming from, I think
Well, I think it's a concern that a lot of people have is that, you know, we're just going to do some sort of symbolic type of thing about this issue and not really address underlying causes, because that's certainly been known to happen. And I don't think that's anything anyone really wants who cares about, who feels that we really have a problem with policing in America. A whole bunch of other stuff lined up for folks on our midweek show. We're going to be talking about, there was that DC statehood vote that the House had on Friday. And so we'll get into that. We'll also get into the AP's announcement that they've changed their style guide to capitalize the B in black when it refers to people.
Which is that's sort of the type of thing that,
there you go, yeah.
Williamson is inveighing against.
We'll get into that. And we'll talk about the monuments coming down, and sometimes monuments you wouldn't expect, like a Ulysses Grant and other things like that. But we'll get into that. And maybe even we'll talk, depending on how much time we have, talk a little bit about federal judges. But all of that will be on the supporters bonus show that comes out every Wednesday for Patreon supporters. If you would like to get that, hey, all you have to do is become a Patreon supporter, and you get, you know, various other things. And to check it all out, again, patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you want all that and just can't afford to become a supporter, just email me, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up. And also, supporter or not, if you could subscribe to the show, leave ratings and reviews, especially if you would share your favorite episodes in social media or other ways. That really helps us out a lot. It doesn't cost you anything. Finally, if you just want to generally get in touch with us with a question, comment, think we blew it or nailed it or what have you, mail@politicsguys.com. We always have some great discussions on our Bipartisan Politics subreddit. You'll find the URL in the show notes. Our Facebook page, which I am recently, the last couple of weeks back on again, facebook.com/politicsguys page. And we're on Twitter @politicsguys, where I sometimes, in my futile efforts to correct Donald Trump, what's wrong with me? Anyway, the executive producer of the Politics Guys, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, and Chris Wilkerson. Today's show is produced by me, Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.